how incredibly hard it is to keep the animal organism from doing our thinking for us. He knows it. He knows it's very hard. He isn't one to downplay that. He says, indeed, without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. He says, but just before the sentence, it still remains true that no justification of virtue will enable a man to be virtuous, and that's something that is very important. Neither will knowing what is virtuous, just knowing it intellectually, see, which is his second line, the intellect is powerless. Just knowing what's good is not going to be able to cause you to be good. Knowing what virtue is, you're not going, just knowing it intellectually, you're not going to be able to have you be it, be virtuous. I see here, what he doesn't mention, but he could, is that neither will education necessarily cause a man to be virtuous. Education will help, is necessary, because we need all the help we can get, but getting trained emotions is not going to necessarily cause us then to be virtuous. It is an enabling step. In a sense, the tragedy of the Greeks that thought knowing the good produced goodness. And then another note there, that there is no enabling power in knowing. There's no enabling power in knowing. Just to know this is not going to be able to enable me to do it.
I don't know if I just haven't been paying attention closely enough, but what I don't quite understand what it even means by trained emotions. I mean, I do, but I don't.
The trained emotions is back to the child who is being
trained to respond to good and bad.
Mm-hmm. And starting really with aesthetics and moving to ethics. Okay. Aesthetic value and then ethical value. And did the brain alone, just to have this abstract principle in your head, is not going to do it. Is not going to... Well, his example is best, and it's the next one. Well, it's the next after. And I'll just go on ahead and... And then, Chris, you asked me if that would clarify some of it. I had sooner play cards against a man who was quite skeptical about ethics, but was bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat. Okay? In other words, he would rather play against that kind of man than against an irreproachable moral philosopher, who intellectually could talk about the moral, morality very well, but who had been brought up among sharpers, card cheats. In other words, the guy who was, although he was fine in moral philosophy, he could cheat at cards without feeling defective. Okay. Whereas the guy who was intellectually quite skeptical about ethics, who was bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat, and who would feel out of harmony cheating, would be a safer man to play cards with. No matter what his intellectual position happens to be, it's that trained emotion, that sentiment. One does not cheat. And then when you cheat, you feel bad. That enables one not to cheat. Whereas the moral philosopher can have all sorts of reasons, justifications for not cheating, and yet his sentiment about cheating is fine. It doesn't bother him.
So you have to go with you have to have the aesthetics first and then ethical?
I mean,
you have to be trained in
that's the proper, that's the ordinate order.
Okay.
to teaching these things. I'm saying, I don't think he says that in any particular place, but that's the way he presented it to us. First, waterfall is sublime, the horses, the, you know, this is beautiful, and so forth, and then you're prepared to know, when you become at the age of reason, to make the connection between that, those are the kinds of value statements, and value statements about being and doing. Okay? And I think that is what is behind this. That first, what's the beautiful, and then it's the right. And then this is one of the greatest, and you've heard me say this, I imagine, before, and it's something that to say again and again, to know. In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of the bombardment. Some kind of sentiment that it's right, proper, to be there, and a feeling associated with that rightness, it's going to take that to stay in the trench and not jump out. And when he says in battle, it's not syllogisms, it's just not little lines of reasoning that are going to keep you there. It's not a line of reasoning that is going to keep you married, if you get married, when the marriage starts to look like a trench, which every marriage at certain times has these battlefield moments. It's not going to be some little bit of, you know, some little intellectual argument that's going to keep you married. It's going to have to be something else, a sentiment, a judgment, and an emotion that overrides all the specific difficulties of the moment. In other words, what's true, and you've heard this one before too, it's got to be true for me. Okay? It's another sort of a thing that Kierkegaard would say. What good does it do me if I understand all the systems and all this stuff, all the moral philosophy? If it's not true for me, it must be true for me. And syllogism is not true for you in the heart, the sentiment. To take, in a sense, to develop a sentiment, according to the Tao, is to take truth up into yourself, up into your being. And in a sense, then be leavened by that, having been taking it into you, really. And then it makes a change. And it keeps. You can stay in the army with syllogisms if you're not in battle. In peacetime, you can get by with syllogisms. In wartime, you can't. And that's, I said, beware of peacetime philosophies. Seek always wartime philosophies. Beware of peacetime theologies. Seek wartime theologies. Right? The crudest sentimentalism, such as G&T would wince at about a flag or country or a regiment, will be of more use. It takes an emotional response to keep you at it. Now, there are better emotional responses and worse ones. And Lewis is saying, even the crudest sentimentalism, and not a sentiment, but just the sentimentalism, you know, for old Brigade One, you know, or the Minnesota Volunteers, you know, whatever, will be of more help keeping you to your duty than some intellectual argument. We were told it all long ago by Plato. As the king governs by his executive, so reason and man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. Now, what is the spirited element?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Then he gives another example to start. He overlays these, and you figure out what the spirited element is according to Plato. And at this point, by the way, in the statement, he starts to warm to the subject, doesn't he? He's starting to warm up more and more each line. The head rules the belly through the chest. The head rules the belly through the chest. And then it's too bad. Seat. Chest. Seat. He didn't know that that was what we call it, rears. But the head rules the belly through the chest. The throne, the place of magnanimity. Of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. Stable sentiments that stay there when the outside looks very stormy. The chest, magnanimity, sentiment. These are the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man, okay? Cerebral man and visceral man, you know? The animal organism. It may even be said that it is by this middle element, it may even be said that it is by this middle element that man is man, that the human man, the human being is human, insofar as this middle element is developed. And if it's not developed, then the implication is that the person, or the Homo sapiens, is not human, which is something that we learn. For by his intellect, he is mere spirit. By his intellect, he is mere spirit, angels. And by his appetite, mere animal. Animal. And there's something maybe in between the human, and that what it is to be human is seen then in that Tao. What it is to be human. The operation of the green book and its kind is to produce what may be called men without chests. Men without chests. Now just to see this here, you get right in the margin, intellect. Okay? Right in the margin, intellect. And then draw an arrow down. Emotions. And then an arrow down. Appetites. Now, I don't know if that's a proper diagram. That's the one Howard has in his margin at that point. Intellect, emotions, appetites.
So, does that imply that spirits are intellect?
This is the control, huh? Through the mind.
Yeah.
The sentiments.
He's also saying that the... that by his intellect he is mere spirit. So in other words, that spirits are intellect?
Say that again.
He's saying that by his intellect he is mere spirit. So then is he saying that spirits are pure intellects?
No. I don't think so. Pure idea. I don't think he's trying to say that. At this point, no. He's not trying to tell us what angels are like. He's saying that by the intellect, what is it?
Is that a false extension? I mean, am I blowing in and extending that idea?
I don't know. I think you're changing the subject. The subject, I think, of this is what's man. The I don't really know the spirit, but when he does, I'll say one thing, that by mere, one thing I can add there is by mere he means that that isn't enough. when Lewis uses mere, it implies that it isn't enough.
Well, right, he's implying that you're not human.
It's not enough to be just spirit.
And it's not enough to be.
It's not enough to be mere animal, just
so
animal.
There's
something more appropriate. It's called the human. It combines both the spirit, which he uses, intellect as part of the spirit, I guess. I don't know how he's getting out and talking about spirits out there. He's talking about something else.
Yeah, I don't understand his use of the word spirit.
I don't either. I do understand it here, but I don't understand it where you're going. I don't know if I can define it in another way that would help you. Can't define it, I don't think. The sense that maybe it would help to say that by the intellect alone, where is it? What is it? The intellect alone.
And then is he saying that the intellect alone is spirit?
Not substance. Yeah, well, it's the spirit. It does not have that the substance
body.
Of the body.
Right.
And so it's, then you have spirit. Okay? It's something that we know exists, but it isn't material. It's spiritual, not material. Spiritual. And then by appetite, we're mere animal, material. And I guess he says, by spirit, by mere spirit, or by intellect, we're mere spirit, and by appetite, mere animal, and by heart is man. The combination, that we have something in between. We're something more than just animal and just spirit, with never the twain shall meet. You know, just emotion, just mind, and nothing in between. That we have a middle part where, that he talks about as the chest, the middle part, between the brain, just between the brain and the balls, there's a chest. There's a part in there. Okay? There's a part in there. And that's the chest, and that's where sentiments come in. It's that middle ground between thought and emotion, between thought and appetite. Okay? To go on with that thing, struggling through, we'll go to the end and then we'll flash back, hopefully, to try to get this up. So that you don't have to frown so much. It is an outrage that they should be commonly spoken of as intellectuals. The operation of the Green Book is the kind to produce what may be called men without chests. It is an outrage that they should be commonly spoken of as intellectuals. This gives them the chance to say that he who attacks them attacks intelligence. It is not so. They are not distinguished from other men by any unusual skill in finding truth or any virginal ardor to pursue her. Indeed, it would be strange if they were. A persevering devotion to truth, a nice sense of intellectual honor, cannot be long maintained without the aid of a sentiment, a value, which Gaius and Titius could debunk as easily as any other. And then this fantastic thing. It is not excess of thought, but defect of fertile and generous emotion that marks them out. It is not an excess of thought, but a defect of fertile and generous emotion that marks them out. Their heads are no bigger than the ordinary. It is the atrophy of the chest beneath that makes them seem so. Because their chests are so small, their heads look bigger. But the head isn't really no bigger. Now this business here starts to change our sense of intellectual a little bit too, doesn't it? Maybe. The sense of it is not excess of thought, but defect of fertile and generous emotion that marks them out. Whether or not we superficially, again, that intellectual arrogance of someone who is not involved in any superficial activities of an intellectual and yet says, enough, got enough, is intellectual arrogance. And here you have the possibility that someone can be an intellectual in that this pejorative sense of the word, by lacking fertile and generous emotion. Their heads are no bigger than the ordinary. It is the atrophy of the chest beneath that makes them seem so. And at all time, such a tragic comedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. We can hardly open a periodical without coming across the statement that what our civilization needs is more drive, dynamism, or self-sacrifice of creativity. In short, a ghastly simplicity. We remove the organ and demand the function. We demand people, valuing things causes these things called up as drive, dynamism, self-sacrifice, and creativity. We take that out. We take away from them the capacity to have emotion, because it's silly, nonsense to value. And then we demand the function, though. Value produced those qualities of self-sacrifice, creativity, dynamism, drive. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. These heads on, get the image, it's just horrible. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. Honor does not make, to be honorable, that's just feeling and it doesn't have any relationship to fact, it's meaningless, it's, don't worry about that. And yet we complain that there are people who are traitorous, to us. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. Which is just slamming. Okay. We take away that the fertility of the generous emotion brings into human life. And then we complain because people, our youth are not as fertile. As courageous as whatever. And keep moving around so much. Keep being so mobile. Just a footnote on that. Creativity is discovery. If no Tao, there is nothing to discover. A world of appearances only. Creativity is discovery. If no Tao, there is nothing to discover. I don't know what I'm talking about. Let's see.
That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there nothing to discover?
Creativity.
Because there's nothing about the Tao. Because everything is just your own reference. There's no other reality that anyone else can understand.
Well, if there's no Tao, there's no impersonal validity. There's no impersonal validity, and I'm in a world of appearances, and I have nothing substantial to discover. And there is no such thing as then creativity. I left out a few steps, but... Now... I want to go back and write this down, maybe on page 13. If it's taken, I don't know, somewhere. Concerning the training of emotions in accordance with objective value. Concerning the training of emotions in accordance with objective value. Concerning the training of emotions in accordance with objective value. Dash. Objective realities require appropriate sentiments. Objective realities require appropriate sentiments. And then sentiments. 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 Which is a word we're struggling for, right? What is that? That's somehow that combination between thought and emotion. It's that bridge between the, you know. It's a bridge. It's our central part. A thought, sentiments. A thought, opinion, or judgment. Resulting from careful consideration and colored by an emotion.
Is the definition of sentiment?
That is a definition of sentiment. I think it's the one that Howard gives. Colored by an emotion. Thought, opinion, or judgment resulting from careful consideration and colored by an emotion. And we still struggle with the meaning of that sentiment, don't we? What is a sentiment? Sentiment. In some ways, we're having to deal with something that is new to us. For certainly, it's a concept that is not something that we're familiar with. But we have a content, an experience in our lives that do give that word meaning. Whether or not we're able to get it out and hand it over to somebody else, I don't know. But do start trying to find in your own life what would be a sentiment that Lewis is talking about. Because it is a new concept for us. But we have experienced some of it. So what is it? Gets concrete content in there so that you can know that you know it, whether you can say what it means or not. I don't worry so much about. Okay. Pick her up again at 2 o'clock. What I told you to write at the beginning on page 13. Okay, I want to change something there. Qualify that. Say it concerns, the chapter concerns the training of emotions in accordance with objective value. Now that implies a couple of things. That implies that it can be done, that the training of emotions can be done. Okay? And he talks a little bit about that, and he'll talk a little more about it as we go. And the second thing it implies is that objective realities require appropriate sentiments. Objective realities require appropriate sentiments. Now, what are objective realities? Objective realities require appropriate sentiments. That's it. Objective realities. Realities outside myself. Person, places, things, ideas, things like that. Certain ideas even, I think. Require appropriate sentiments. Now that I was talking to Chris a little after the class about trying to figure out a better definition of sentiments, something that, because we don't use that word, but Lewis, I think, has given us a word that's as close as we can get, and attitudes. Attitudes is about the best. Sentiments are certain attitudes toward persons, places, things, events, and even ideas that are really true to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. This is from a, he says this on one of the pages, I can't remember which one, but I'm trying to grasp what a sentiment is. It's a certain attitude that is true to the kind of place the universe is and the kind of things we are.
You can't have wrong sentiments?
It's possible to have unreasonable attitudes toward objective realities. It is. It's possible. But they are unreasonable then. And he goes to go on and to get this sort of nutshell sort of idea of what he's doing. He says these attitudes towards that are true to the kind of thing the universe is and kinds of things we are combinations of thought and emotion. I think that we can see that more clearly when we say the word attitude. An attitude toward cheating. I have certain thoughts involved there and I have emotions involved there too. Okay? That attitude involves both thought and emotion, idea and feeling. These attitudes are combinations of thought and emotion, and I said that in the other thing I had you write down, sentiments, a thought, opinion, or judgment resulting from careful consideration and colored by an emotion. That, I think, is wrong. Okay? Why would that be wrong? A thought, opinion, or judgment resulting from careful consideration and colored by an emotion. Is it as a definition of sentiment?
Sounds like you thought out how to
get. Okay, that's it. Right on. That you come to these sentiments through thought, reasoning process. Okay? That's not so. The attitudes are not arrived through thought and emotion, but if accepted, careful consideration in time can show them to be reasonable. But one of his main points is that these sentiments that we have to be human are not things arrived at by logical argument. There are things that are gotten, givens, that we accept from the Tao. Then after we have accepted them, in time we see the rightness of those attitudes. But it does take time often. Okay? Time is important. Time is very important to an understanding of the Tao. We've talked about these short time frames, and the Tao tells what is valuable and what is so over a long period of time. Tested 10,000 years, say. Okay. And well, I'll come back to another point to make there. But these primary attitudes, the Tao gives us the primary attitudes. And these primary attitudes, to me, it's meaningful to say felt ideas. Felt ideas. It's an important combination because many times I don't... Well, let me wait. On that. These primary attitudes are felt ideas, judgments felt to be proper or improper. Now, the Tao tells me what these primary attitudes are. Primary, what is valuable, what is proper in responding to objective realities, things outside myself, that there is a proper response. The Tao tells me that. Now, Karen, your question about, you know, can you have improper attitudes? Yes. And the improperness of them is seen by measuring the attitude that you have toward children against the Tao. See? Our attitude at this particular moment in time toward, say, children is judged reasonable or unreasonable according to how close it fits the Tao's primary statement of the primary attitude. And the Tao tells what the proper attitudes are. And if I'm within the objective reality, then my attitude is to be judged reasonable or unreasonable in accordance to the Tao, proper or improper, in accordance, in relationship to the Tao. Now, that is a bit scary, if that's so, okay? This whole business is a little bit scary if it's so. Now, one thing I'd like to say about this, about these sentiments being thought or felt ideas of what is right, that in the kinds of situations that I get in, or a person gets in, especially battlefield type situation, crisis situations, the I need more than just thought to do the right thing. I need more than just emotion to do the right thing. Sometimes the thoughts are coming so fast and are so confused, my own thinking is so confused, that I can't know to do the right thing. Then if I, this sentiment, this attitude is held in me, that attitude can help me do the right thing. Or my thoughts can't help me a bit. As he paraphrases that, or I'm paraphrasing him, really. He says, the intellect won't do you any good. Syllogism won't keep you in the trench. Syllogism won't keep you in the marriage. The specific instances that you're involved in make you very confused intellectually as to what's so. And if you have this sentiment, this chest, this attitude built in, you will have better chances to do what should be done. You are so, when you get in a trench, your time frame is so short. You're looking at a tiny piece of time that you can't see what's right. And the sentiment will tell you what the right thing to do is from a bigger time reference. Or you're zeroed in so close. In many cases, and I mentioned it one night at the end of a Tournier discussion about how, you know, if someone robs me of my time, if someone takes time away from me, I will respond like an organism. You know, there's the thing on the old thing in Kansas when the CO thing, when the 9 foot, was it the 9 foot nigger jumps through the window to rape your wife, what you gonna do? You know, if you use force on the person, then you're supposed to go to the army, you know, this kind of thing. That was good. If you say you'll use any force at all, then you're not a conscientious objector. That was the assumption. And my answer to that is I'd hit the guy over the head with a chair, and I'd be dead wrong. It's very important for me to know that. And to understand that as my time has been taken away, you see, and I've responded with a mere organism, as an organism.
Your time to contemplate?
Yeah, there's no time. There's no, not to contemplate it. If I contemplated it, I'd still have, you know. That's a hypothetical that doesn't work either, you know, right? Because the guy doesn't jump through the window and give you time enough to consider, you see. But if indeed my time was taken away, I'd respond as an organism. But I'd have to know, too, that I was wrong. I was forced, in a sense, to be wrong in my response. why it's important not to justify doing that is that if you justify that, then you the next day, you, from that justification, that first justification, it follows. Certain things start to follow once you start to justify it. Once you try to say that an irrational organism reaction is rational, then on that basis, you next thing you do is buy a gun for your to protect your house, and the next thing you do is you can shoot certain people, and so forth. Logically, the progression just starts overtaking. Pretty soon, it's okay to fight aggressive wars because someone is jumping, economically jumping through my country's window. You know, to wreck our well-being, you know. And so I've got to stop that. And so I nail somebody before he can even jump through the window. See? Someone is trying to. And that is all a logical sort of progression from that. But that's another sort of another story. But when the sentiments are there, you know, what our emotions tell us about this little tiny piece of time can get us to do something that's wrong. Because the Tao knows, say, that we live in time, although we forget it in intense moments. The Tao knows that the person we're, say, we're dealing with lives in time, although they can tend to forget it. Say, two consenting adults can forget that they live in time. But the Tao will say, you do live in time. And you will see in time that that's certain thing is wrong, and I hope you don't see that, discover that it is, you know, evidentially. But we, our emotions, we tend to get lost and think that the, you know, all that reality is, what should be done is seeable right now. And when we get in those situations, trenches, our emotions by themselves can't help us. Our emotions will be screaming, we'll get out of this trench and run. You know, our mind intellects alone will be saying, get out of this trench and run. And the sentiment will say, it is important that you stay here because those three people will be killed if you go. See? Surely be killed if you go. For sure. And Tao would say, stay in the trench. And you would have to have a sentiment, and have to have a strongly held attitude that the certain thing was right to do, to stay there. In marriage trenches, in relationship trenches, and all sorts of different trenches. Now, that's not something that Lewis is talking about right at this time, but that is a sort of a rationale for taking this chapter very seriously in the next one too. To face that sense of defective, this is what he's claiming, and you really are going to be put under a great deal of stress not to back away from that claim of defect. We have not been schooled to think that there are absolute values. And the Tao says that there are absolute values.
Does the Tao say there's absolute values, or is the Tao absolute values?
There, well, it would say that too.
It is, and it would say it?
Mm-hmm. The absolute, and we are trained, schooled. I think that if you ask 99% of people on the street, of course there are no absolutes. No absolute values. What's right to do in a situation is dependent upon the mood and the occasion and so forth. I mean, it's, in other words, it's relative to the mood, the occasion, the situation, the fact that someone is consenting or not, you know, all these things. That's what's significant. But there aren't any real absolute values. The Tao is in direct contradiction with 99% of the people. And remember, he says in there too, he is under no illusion that the Tao is being taught. He says one has to teach this whether anyone believes it or not. What are his exact words? He says, that for those within the Tao, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not. Those appropriate responses. That's on 31. Now, it isn't a question of how many people believe this. One other thing, Don just came over, he's going to sit with the kids while Lisa's at this thing, and he said, I've just been reading about this takeover of a Lufthansa airliner and how the Germans went in, and then I was reading about how 20 people in New York, lawyers and real estate people and so forth, have just been sent to jail or something for arson, you know. Lawyers and real estate agents and owners and all sorts of things, and policemen and everything, sent to jail for arson, for having burnt down millions and millions and millions of dollars of property in order to get insurance money and so forth, and like that. And then he says, and it's just been bugging me, and you know, and then I says, yeah, and he says, that's exactly, we're talking about some things pretty close to that in abolition. He says, yep, that's exactly what I thought when I came in the door. I bet you this is related to the abolition of man. And I said, yeah, he says that really, if you don't come down on the side of objective value, you can't logically think anything that'll keep you from becoming a terrorist or doing that kind of thing. You may be better than your principles, but your principles won't keep you from doing it. And that is what is at stake. That's what Lewis is claiming is at stake. And I think I agree with that. Now, if that's so, we could be in a rather uncomfortable situation. And that's to see. But don't meet this statement. Don't say, because you don't know that it isn't so. You know, I mean, we can't, what we've been taught, assumed to be so, we don't know is so. We've been given a theory. See? We've been, it has not been a theory that has been put into our minds, but an assumption. It's not a theory that we got, it's an assumption. Most of us share it. I certainly did. I certainly do. A great deal of myself right now still functions that way because of that's the way I was, you know. Although intellectually I might, what I know intellectually hasn't caught up with my, or my life hasn't caught up to what I accept intellectually. Because in a sense I was raised where attitudes were not a focus of any of my education outside my family. In my family I did get that. I did get some understanding of the Tao, but I got none of that from the other education that I've had. And another irony is I think it's against the law to give this kind of education in school. Now this next chapter, The Way, and I just read what I also have said here. In this chapter, my mouth falls open in awe and humility before the God who gives such power to men. No, but I can't say God. So, in this chapter, my mouth falls open in awe and humility before the the nature which gives such power to men, or whatever. I'm reminded of something Orwell said about Melville. Orwell is a fantastic guy to read, and he said, whoever is not queasy in the presence of strength will always love Melville. Whoever is not queasy in the presence of strength will always love Melville. Whoever is not queasy in the presence of strength will always love Lewis, too. But I get queasy sometimes, see, reading this next chapter. The middle of the argument is sound, the footnotes incredibly brilliant for their sense and economy. We aren't going to talk about the footnotes. That would be another whole other thing. But the footnotes are magnificent, to where he can, in such short order, deal with some very basic questions. They are fantastic to go back and reread. With my mind, I know that what he says is true. Okay. With my mind, I know what he says is true. I lack the content to say what he says in other words. But perhaps this isn't the case. I mean, my lack of content, perhaps, is the... Well, wait a minute. What did I mean by that? Yeah. Okay. In my mind, I know what he says is true. I lack the content to say what he says in other words. But perhaps what I mean is that I lack content. I lack. Well, that's exactly what I said. I lack the content to come up with my own words to say what he says, and yet I know what he says is so. Perhaps this chapter is a rational poem that escapes, swallows all paraphrase. Like a poem. You cannot paraphrase a poem and come close to it. And in many cases, to talk about it, you know, it'll escape and swallow all paraphrase. And we'll still go ahead and do it. But it is the chapter itself is like a rational poem. And Lewis has done this to me before. He does it in the one section of Four Loves, where absolutely I just run up against it and I say, you know, I can't go follow you anymore. I know you're right, but I also know that I have not been able to think your thoughts. And that's one reason why we spend a lot of time on this too. To actually be able to think someone else's thoughts. To know what he meant, what he implied, and so forth. Now, we've made it up to here, I think. Or we're, you know, we've pushed our way through it, okay? We know where he went. Maybe we didn't get to think those thoughts yet, completely. But we know that that's a meaningful phrase, I think, for what can happen. We, in a sense, we've followed Lewis a good deal of the way. We can't follow him completely unless we, in a sense, agree. And we can't really agree until we've read the book. But I think you'll see some real, very interesting things here when, after we're done talking, you read it again. You know, you'll be amazed. Okay? And that experience of actually being able to think someone's thoughts is it's wonderful. And I haven't been able to follow, to think all of Lewis's thoughts here in the whole book. We'll get there someday. In heaven, maybe. Okay.
Chuck?
Yeah?
I don't know if I should just wait and let it will complex, but I really don't feel very ready to go on.
Okay.
I'm still sort of like with page 34. I feel
okay.
Confused.
34.
Talking about the middle element and this in between the cerebral man and the visceral man.
Visceral, I think.
Visceral man.
Yeah.
And how
Okay.
Still
he says, let's call it a chest, because there is something that is between the intellect and the emotion alone. And that's a kind of certain kinds of attitudes that are strange combinations of emotions and thoughts, felt ideas, strongly felt ideas. And then he says, since we say that there's the, you know, the mind, the head, and the bowels, okay, for the appetites, the bowels, the head, the intellect, the chest, in between. Let's call it that. And there is where one has, if one does have sentiments, that's where one has it. Let's say, in the chest. But then he just makes that picture. And then he says, if we don't educate one way, we will get men with chests. If we educate, in other words, we will get men who do have just sentiments. If we educate another way, we'll have people who are heads and bowels, but not any real sentiments.
Okay. Then going back up, as a king governs by his executive, so reason in man, the intellect, even if it's capitalized.
Okay. Well, capitalized there is when he capitalizes that, he's talking about reason in terms of the Tao, I believe, isn't he?
As an equivalent?
So reason, the Tao active in me must rule the appetites. The Tao active in me must rule the appetites. But that since I've got to accept the Tao, I've got to accept the Tao, and then it can rule my appetites.
Through, by means of the spirited element, which is then the...
I don't know what Plato means with spirited element.
But is Lewis using that as being the seat of the sentiments?
Huh? I see. Okay, well, the way Plato meant it, I think there, I'm sorry for misleading you there, because I was thinking Lewis said that. He's paraphrasing Plato, and so reason in man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. The spirited element would be the, what the next person says is the chest.
Okay.
Those attitudes that are in accordance with the Tao. I think that's it. Does that not make sense to anybody? Or seem like, it might not make sense, but does it seem like that's wrong? Anyone? I think in that situation, Plato was saying the reason, the mind of man must rule the appetites of man through the sentiments, the attitudes that are in accordance with the Tao. And then the next, what? Okay.
Okay. If I'm going to read the Tao, reason, capital reason being is Tao in me, so the Tao in me, or the Tao...
No. I told you that first, but I said that was...
Okay.
If Lewis said that, when Lewis capitalizes reason, he's talking about something else. Reason itself.
Okay.
The Tao is reason itself. And in the next chapter he shows how he makes that distinction.
The Tao is reason itself.
Reason itself, yeah.
Okay.
And that's a subject that he comes up in the next chapter. When Plato says it, I think he's thinking in terms of the mind, the intellect. There's a job to do. The appetites need to be controlled. The intellect cannot do that by itself. Some combination of emotion and intellect has to be there that can do it.
Okay.
The spirited element is going to be that heart, the heart that holds certain attitudes as right. Strongly felt. That's right.
Okay, let me read just one more sentence.
Okay.
The head rules the belly through the chest. The sea, as Alanis tells us, of
magnanimity.
Magnanimity of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. And then are these equivalent? The chest, magnanimity. And sentiment are also to be equivalent terms?
Well, he's using that when we say the chest, we mean having the just sentiments. Magnanimity is another word for having just sentiments. Having a chest is another way of saying we have just sentiments. Those are all important liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. Now that's important. I'm glad you got back to that, because the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. Man is spirit, man is organism. Are these sentiments. Now, liaison officers, do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Go between.
And they go both ways, don't they?
Right.
Okay. And they go both ways. They go both ways. And then, you know, that when I talk about having a passionate mind and an informed heart. By informed heart, some of what I mean by that is this having these sentiments, these just sentiments, an informed heart, and the heart and a passionate mind, that where the mind is not separated from the passion which the visceral man can help. We need the passion. The mind needs the passion of the bowels, you know. And the emotions need the coherence of the mind, you know. The coherence the mind can bring. And that's at that sentence. Magnanimity, I'll give you sort of a definition of that I have written down here if you'd like. It's a beautiful word, magnificent word. Noble in mind, high-souled, generous in overflowing, in overlooking injury or insult. Generous in overlooking injury and insult. Comes from the Latin magnus, meaning great, and animus, meaning mind, soul. See animal, living being, breathe air, life, principle. What's that? Ooh. Or another word for animus is living being, breath, air, spirit, life, principle, soul, all biggies. Greek word pneuma, spirit. Great spirit. It's kind of a neat, the great spirit. Akawasani notes, or whatever it is. Great spirit. The Greek word too for, or a word that, the Greek word is epiekes, that is used, translated as magnanimity. And in Philippians, let your forbearance be known to all men, let your magnanimity be known to all men, let your tolerance be known to all men. Those are all just small parts of what the word epiekes means, and I would say that epiekes is the best word there for that. Check epiekes out in Barclay's New Testament words. Generous is a good word for that too. Is that, Karen, does that make you feel like you can?
I feel a little more comfortable.
Anything more then, I should, because we went over that pretty fast, that part, those pages.
Does the Tao act in me, or is it something in me that acts, that responds to the Tao?
I can accept the Tao, be taught the Tao, to accept the Tao. It becomes a part of me. It then is active in me. But I'm trained into that, trained emotions. For it not to be active in me is something that I can hold it with my mind, and that's that. But it isn't really true for me. The Tao, true for me, within my existence, would mean that there's a chest there.
But are you saying then that there's no way you can come to a realization of the Tao without training?
You need some kind of training. But that training can be done in different ways. A lot of that training can be done through example. From paying attention, you know. But it would be good to have a little more of that than less, not to just leave it up to accident, which I think in many cases it is.
Yeah, but as it got started, presumably
it was trained.
It was trained from the
Greeks.
The beginning of man.
The Greeks taught it. The people taught it. Yeah.
Well, what about like an Aboriginal culture?
They teach them.
Yeah, but.
Parents
have they
the
always
kids.
Taught?
Yeah.
Where does it come from?
Well, you know, my asking my folks, you know, who was God's dad, you know? Who was God's dad and mom? It's that kind of question. It's that sort of abyss before the creation kind of situation. Where did it come from? That's why I mentioned, is the Tao the race's projection? Remember the natural symbols that Langer talks about? Mm-hmm. Somehow we all have natural symbols, no matter what our culture. Well, now is the Tao, do we have, just as we have archetypal symbols, for the Jung tells us, the psychologist Jung tells us, are there archetypal values? Is that something that we project, or is it something that just, you know, that was actually given? And he talks about that in this next chapter too. Is there a supernatural origin to the Tao? I don't know. And then he goes on. Remember? That part where he talks about theism? Whether this position implies a supernatural origin for the Tao is a question I am not here concerned with. He's not going to talk about that. Because that gets involved in... Then he has to talk about things we can't talk about right now. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Where
but
did
I
it
think
come
it
from?
It might be...
Hmm? It's definitely.
Well, we are trained into it, but I would think also that without training one would possibly come into it.
Could come into some of it. The thing about training is that, as you see in this next chapter, it's very important to get a good sense of the Tao. Big sense of the Tao. One problem that G and T have is a rotten sense of history. You know. They really haven't taught too much about any times outside their own. But we're actually, after all, we're progressed, see. We've been making so much progress these last few years that we really don't have to pay attention to these old truths. We have these truths now. And then, if you had a sense of history, you'd realize that what you're claiming to be a new truth is really standing in opposition to 20,000 years of human history. Then you are a little less cocky about, you know, you feel like maybe there's a little bit more of a burden of proof on you if you know your history. In other words, as he'll talk about in this next chapter, what do you do if somebody says, you know, why about this? You know, so why should I do that? No. Who cares? And he says, you can't talk to such a guy. That's what he'll say. You just can't talk to somebody like that. And he will say that the burden of proof, this goes back so far and was the principle, objective reality, was the principle, is the principle involved in all those things, the Stoic conception, the Chinese conception, the Christian conception, the Jewish conception, the Aristotelian conception, that if I don't want to agree with it, the burden of proof is on me. I can't say to the Tao, prove it. I have to prove in some way how that is not sensible. But I have to prove it. I cannot go around demanding proof of the Tao. Come on, prove it. And that's what he says. The person who says prove it's an ape in pants. That's what he'll say. You can't talk to him. He just slams that home. And yet you've read this the first time, you know, and you go cruising along, and the closer you understand what he's talking about, the more you say, prove it, you know, and he's saying you can't talk to somebody who says prove it. And that's sort of, wait a minute, and the implication is that that person is, if the person isn't better than his principles, then that person is really lost. Okay? Well, let's get in, we're getting into the second chapter's points now, so let's go there, okay? Or was there some other particular thing there? In those last pages, anybody else have something that was troubling particularly? Okay, this next sentence is one of the zingers of all time, okay? The practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book must be the destruction of the society which accepts it. Made point blank. If no objective value, then destruction of the society that doesn't, you know, that accepts that. If all value is subjective, the destruction of the society which accepts it. There's the connection with Don Singh. Good heavens, every time you pick up a paper, you're getting more of this stuff. You know, and terrorism and arson and so forth and like that. So some of that's proof. Of this statement. That's a huge claim, isn't it? But then, if you thought that was big, the next one. But this is not necessarily a refutation of subjectivism about values as a theory. What is the referent of this?
Times before.
Hmm?
The destruction.
Yeah. But just because society may be destroyed, if this is accepted, this is not necessarily a refutation of the theory. I mean, you don't refute the theory because the theory is going to lead to destruction.
You don't refute the theory
No.
because the theory is going to lead to destruction.
He says not necessarily. He says just, in other words, he's saying just because if this theory is accepted, the society will be destroyed is not good support for refuting this theory. It's one of the disadvantages, maybe, of the theory. But it's not going to refute it. But if that theory is going to be refuted, it'll have to be on other grounds. And then, the third statement, the true doctrine, might be a doctrine which, if we accept, we die.
Then acceptance of it depends on whether or not, only if it's the truth, not whether or not we die or not.
Yeah, survival has nothing to do with it. If it's true, it's true. It's true, it's true. It's true. But if we live according to the truth, we may die. Okay? That is no refuge. The fact that we die does not refute the true doctrine. Now, but this is not going back to the second one. But this is not necessarily a refutation of subjectivism about values as a theory. In other words, value of survival is not the ultimate criterion. You know, value of survival is not the highest criterion. Survival is not the highest value.
Is that what he's saying?
That's something that we can say at that point. To think, we should think that. You can't say that. You can't say that. First statement. This kind of education can destroy society, and this is not necessarily a refutation of subjectivism about values as a theory, and not also hold that the survival is not the ultimate criterion. Survival is not the highest value. That is something else that you would believe in saying that. If you thought that survival was the highest value, to hell with the rationality, logicality, or whatever of it. You know, we reject that theory because we don't survive. Lewis is saying that he doesn't. The true doctrine might be a doctrine which, if we accept, we die. Dying is survival is important, you know, but it isn't the all-important thing that makes us throw a rationality out the window or the Tao out the window or whatever else.
It seems that G&T would think that survival was the highest.
That's what he'll go about trying to show, how they're going to try to come up with some value, and they will pick survival, okay? They'll pick survival as the value that they're going to try to prove. Remember? And he ties it in with dulce et decorum est. Now, no one who speaks from within the Tao could reject it on that account. Bang. No one who speaks from within the Tao can reject a theory because it means his death. Now there's some Greek there that is not Koine Greek. I couldn't find anybody that knew classical Greek. The closest we could come to was both in the growth and the destruction. Both in the appearing and destruction phenomenon. And I don't understand quite how that works.
Why do you expect people to understand?
Well, he's taught his audience is his audience, the people he was talking to knew Greek, Latin, probably, at least, probably German. One thing interesting to feel like you're a real dummy is that Lewis was really good at knowing his audience. I mean, he spoke to his audience when he was writing lay stuff. You know, he does a real good job. He doesn't do some of these toughies like this. He's given this orally to a group that he knows, that they can follow him. Boy, you want to, that makes me feel like a real uneducated, you know, jerk.
Well, I don't understand that listening and listening to it.
Yeah. I'm sure there was an outcry for a book after he was done, though. You know, I'm sure they kind of said, that was a wonderful thing. Great, it was tremendous to follow you through that. It's fine. Are you going to do a book on this? When will it be out? Because
I'd like to read it and then talk to you about it.
Yes, I'd like to talk to you about it, but I have a busy, you know, I have an appointment for about 2 years. When's the book due? Okay, there's not yet come to that. He says it has not gotten so far that it's this bad. I mean that the destruction has already happened or anything, but there. And then he drops it. That jerky. There are theoretical difficulties in the philosophy of G&T, however subjective they may be about some traditional value. G&T have shown by the very act of writing the Green Book that there must be some other values about which they are not subjective at all. Okay? There must be some values which they accept as real, or they wouldn't have even bothered to write. Okay? They write in order to produce certain states of mind in a rising generation, if not because they think those states of mind intrinsically just or good, yet intrinsically, that's a good thing, intrinsically. Certain states of mind, certain attitudes are intrinsically just and good. Almost by themselves, what do you say? Well, their nature is it their just reward? Yet certainly because they think them to be the means to some state of society which they regard as desirable. Okay? They're a means. It would not be difficult to collect from various passages in the Green Book what their ideal is, but we need not. The important thing is not that the is not the precise nature of their end, but the fact that they have an end at all. The fact that they have an end at all. They must have, or their book is written to no purpose, and this end must have real value in their eyes. And they have a purpose for writing. They have an end in sight, and that end has got to have some value or they wouldn't write it. They wouldn't write the book. In other words, having ends implies value is given to something. Having an end, ends and means. Having an end implies that you value something. You've given value to something. Now, to abstain from calling it good and to use instead such predicates as necessary or progressive or efficient would be a subterfuge. They don't like to call things good. But he says, they'll probably say this is a progressive end. This is an efficient end, a necessary end. It's a subterfuge. They would be forced by argument to answer the questions necessary for what, progressing toward what, effecting what. In the last resort, they would have to admit that some state of affairs was, in their opinion, good for its own sake. Something was valuable, really was valuable. It wasn't just my feelings about it. There was something, a state of affairs that is actually valuable. Okay? They would be forced to admit that. And this time, they could not maintain that good simply described their own emotions about it. For the whole purpose of their book is so to condition the young reader that he will share their approval, and this would be either a fool's or a villain's undertaking unless they held that their approval was in some way valid or correct. In actual fact, G&T will be found to hold with complete uncritical dogmatism the whole system of values which happened to be in vogue among moderately educated young men of the professional classes during the period between the two wars. Their skepticism about values is on the surface. It is, okay, it's an attitude that's picked up. One which C.S. Lewis held. Okay? Lewis argues very well for other people. He believes X, somebody else believes the opposite. He has an uncanny way of arguing their case better than they can. He does that. He'll do that. If you read his essays, you'll see him do it again and again. He's arguing these people's case. In this case, he held those opinions after World War I. Now he says, their skepticism about values is on the surface. It is for use on other people's values. About the values current in their own set, they are not nearly skeptical enough. Now we're pretty free . Let me go back a little bit to the in the last resort they would have to admit that some state of affairs was, in their opinion, good for its own sake. Good for its own sake implies inherent good. Inherent good. But there are some things that are good for their own sake. Now he says, okay, if they're going to finally have to admit that some state of affairs is good for its own sake, in other words, there is some inherent value. And now he is sort of easy on G&T. He says G&T doesn't really fight so hard, but they've got these borrowed ideas from somebody else that they never really thought through. They found this sort of a certain arguments that can be made to destroy other people's values, okay? And so they've used them, and they got to be knowing fellows, okay? But that they didn't all the time. They did have values. And they never used the same tools they used to destroy the other people's values on themselves. And that's And this phenomenon is very unusual, in the sense that you use what you know about psychology on other people. You know, they're paranoid. But, you know, seldom do we turn the same understandings on ourselves and realize that we're paranoid. They've got these problems, but we tend to think that the principles of psychology and principles of rhetoric and so forth are for use on foreigners only. You know, we by nature we do that. We use them on other people, and we shouldn't. Says the Tao, I suppose. This phenomenon is very usual. A great many of those who debunk traditional, or as they would say, sentimental values, have in the background values of their own, which they believe to be immune from the debunking process. Now that's pretty clear. One of Lewis's purposes in this chapter is to show that that's not true, that their values are not immune from the debunking process. So in some ways, what's the guy doing? G&T have used a debunking process to get rid of value. But they really want to keep some things as valuable. Now Lewis will use the same process to take their value away from them. He'll take their argument and wipe out their argument. Okay? He's going to debunk them. And it's kind of odd. And he'll do a much clearer job, a more eloquent job of debunking than G&T did in the first place. Okay. They claim to be cutting away the parasitic growth of emotion, religious sanction, and inherent. And remember, there must be a good deal part of you, because there's a good part of me still at 31 that says, hey, come on now. You know, tradition, sentimental values. You know, I got an awful lot of stuff in my head about traditional, you know, no value in traditional. Well, those are traditional values. And by saying they're traditional values, I mean they're not valuable. See? A great deal of me has been trained by default almost, or just soaking it up through my gills by osmosis or whatever, however I got it. Anyway, traditional values are sentimental values, and they don't really relate to anything really valuable. They claim to be cutting away the parasitic growth of emotion, religious sanction, and inherited taboos. Okay? Taboos. How many bull sessions have you had talking about taboos and traditions and sentimentality? I don't know if you've done that or not. Have you? Taboo. Oh, that's just a taboo, some kind of a thing. Taboo means Tao. It will mean Tao. The taboos of tribes. Those are the show attitudes towards certain things. It is taboo to do this. You know, do that. Do that. That's the Tao. He wants to cut all that parasitic growth of whatever. I've never figured out what that meant. Parasitic growth of, and you've heard it a lot, parasitic growth of that phrase. I mean, parasitic growth of emotion. I don't understand it. He's using the other guy's phrases. You want to cut away that away and reveal the real and basic values, or so that real and basic values may emerge. I will now try to find out what happens if this is seriously attempted. Now he's going to seriously, with all the force of his mind, try to do what G&T were trying to do. Let us continue to use the previous example, that of death for a good cause. Not, of course, because virtue is the only value, or martyrdom the only virtue, but because this is the experimentum crucis, I guess you'd say, the experiment of the cross, the and what that means, he just follows with it. This case will show the different systems of thought in the clearest light. Let us suppose that the innovator in values regards dulce et decorum, sweet and decorous. It is to die for your country. He doesn't mention the rest of it. But the greater love hath no man Yeah, greater love hath no man. What? Okay, well, he's slipping something else in there, but dulce et decorum est is the... It is sweet and decorous to die for your country. As mere irrational sentiments, which are to be stripped off in order that we may get down to the realistic or basic ground of this value. Where will he find such a ground? He'll try. First of all, he might say that the real value lay in the utility of such sacrifice to the community.